Griffith University is a Gold Coast institution and continues to grow. Its dynamic urban campus blending seamlessly into the region's world-class attractions. And now, partnering with the Gold Coast's cultural leader, Hotter Home of the Arts, we're proud to present our signature thought leadership and conversation series, helmed by master interviewer Kerry O'Brien. Welcome to A Better Future for All.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome. My name is Carolyn Evans. I'm the Vice-Chancellor and President of Griffith University, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to A Better Future for All, a series of conversations with leading journalist and author Kerry O'Brien, which is proudly co-hosted by Griffith University and Hotter, the Home of the Arts, here on the beautiful Gold Coast. May I begin by proudly acknowledging the traditional custodians on the lands on which we're situated, the Kumbumeri families of the Yugambeh language region. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and recognise their continuing connections to the lands, waters, and their extended communities throughout southeast Queensland. You are all very welcome here tonight. Can I particularly acknowledge the councillors of the City of Gold Coast who are with us here tonight, William Owen Jones and Pauline Young, and other members of the Griffith and Hotter leadership groups. While unfortunately she couldn't be with us tonight, I do want to acknowledge Krina Gurkha. This is the last one of the Better Future for All series that we will run under her leadership because unfortunately she is leaving Hotter at the end of this year. It's been a bumpy partnership since we decided in late 2019 that it would be a great idea to run a series of conversations from 2020 onwards, but it has been wonderful partnering with Hotter and we will certainly miss Krina. Now, despite the number of people on the stage tonight, we will be welcoming two high-profile Australian mental health advocates to explore the prevalence of mental health issues afflicting Australians and the need for proactive prevention and early intervention. Professor Patrick McGorry's plane was delayed. He is but moments away, as we understand it. We have somebody standing by the back door ready to rush him through. I'm going to speak slowly as I introduce them in the hope that he will be here. But we've already got one wonderful guest, which is good. But one of our guests tonight is Professor Patrick McGorry, AO. Patrick's an expert in adolescent mental health at the University of Melbourne and former Australian of the Year in 2010. He is an internationally renowned psychiatrist known for his work in early intervention and youth mental health services. As the founder of Headspace, Australia's first integrated youth mental health service, and executive director of the Translational Mental Health Research Institute, Origin, Professor McGorry is a pioneer in establishing early intervention models of care for young people in this country. Joining us already on the stage is author, educator and podcaster Hugh Van Kylenberg, who has more than 15 years' experience working in mental health education. As the founder of the Resilience Project, Hugh works in a range of educational and corporate settings, from schools to elite sporting clubs. The Resilience Project provides positive mental health and resilience-enhancing strategies to improve wellbeing among young people and community, with the goal of cultivating more mindful, connected and fulfilling lives. So I'm delighted to welcome them both this evening, and how important and timely this topic is. The latest national study of mental health and wellbeing revealed that over 40% of Australians have experienced diagnosable mental health issues at some point in their lives. And sadly, children and young adults are particularly vulnerable, with 2 in 5 young people aged 16 to 24 reporting experience of a mental health disorder lasting 12 months or more, but only half of these people, or in fact fewer than half, receiving any treatment. So working together to improve our mental health system, to improve mental health outcomes for our young people has never been more important. Here at Griffith University, we're proud to have more than 20 years' experience conducting mental health research, with a particular focus on the mental health of children and young people, community engagement, and suicide prevention. As an institution, we recently cemented the importance of projects conducted in these fields by our researchers through the establishment of Griffith Centre for Mental Health, and I'd like to welcome some of our colleagues who are here from that centre tonight. The centre provides a space for multidisciplinary collaboration across fields including health, but also business, education, criminology and science to inform and enhance mental health research, translation and impact. We've already done a lot in this area, but we know that with this centre there's more to come. So with creating a better future in mind, and this our last for the 2022 series, We're extremely pleased to have with us, as always, our master interviewer, Kerry O'Brien, and at the moment, Hugh, and before too long, Patrick. Please join with me in welcoming them. Thank you and enjoy.
I'm going to start the conversation tonight by drawing two very different profiles of Australian mental health practitioners and see what we can learn from the combination of the two. And Hugh van Kylenberg, I'll actually start with you, not that I have much choice. You were forced to switch on to mental illness as an adolescent at home. Let's start your story there.
I will. Just before we kick off, I very nearly, as a treat for the audience, it's quite dark up here, I very nearly missed my chair when I walked on here. I was so close to missing my chair.
Now, that could have been an exercise in resilience.
Yeah, I think it would have been a real-life test for everyone. The other thing is, just before Patrick gets here, I've never met him before, and I might be his biggest ever fan, and so you guys will watch when he walks on stage. I'll be trying very hard to play it cool, just know that. But inside, I'm going to be extremely excited, so just you can look out for that. What was the question? I was thinking about Patrick.
Where we start the story, which is you as an adolescent, as a teenager, at home, pretty happy family, but then not.
Yeah, so when I was, when my little sister was 14 years old and I was 3 years older than her back then.
Still are.
What a start. It's funny that, it's never changed. It's always been that. So when my sister was 14, I was 17 and I remember Mum and Dad came into my room and they said, "We just want to sit you down, I want to tell you something." They said, "Your little sister's not well." And I remember saying, "She looks fine." They said, "Well, she's got a mental illness." And it was in 1996. And we weren't talking about mental illness in the 90s, especially not in school. So I had no idea what they were talking about. And they explained that she had a thing called anorexia nervosa, and they said she hates the way that she looked and she's just stopped eating. So I just remember thinking, that can't be that serious. If eating food is what's going to get her better, I can't imagine that this is too serious. I'd heard about people with cancer and they couldn't help them, and I just thought, that can't be that serious. Fast forward 4 years, my sister's meant to be her first day of year 12, very, very hot February morning in Melbourne, I'll never, ever forget it, and she's admitted to hospital for the first time in her battle because she dropped below crisis weight. And I remember sitting in the hospital bed with her, and I'd been there for a couple of hours. I remember the doctor walked in, he looked at his watch, and he said, "Sorry, mate, you got to go." And I said, "I've only been here for 2 hours." He said, "That's all you get." He said, "I've told your sister, when she puts on a little bit more weight, you can stay for more than 2 hours tomorrow. When she puts on more weight, she puts more..." Yeah, he said, "You're her incentive, so I need you to leave." And I said, "Right." And I remember as I left, I just turned around and said, "I'm so sorry. How much does she need to put back on so I can stay for more than 2 hours tomorrow?" And he told me her total weight, which I didn't want... I'd switched off from that ages ago. I didn't want to know, but he didn't know that. He said, "I've told your little sister." He said, "When she gets back up to..." And she's not a short person. She's about probably 5'7", 5'8". He said, "I've told her when she gets back up to 31 kilograms, I'll consider letting you stay for more than 2 hours." I'll never forget it. She looked like something from a horror movie. Now, fast forward a few weeks, she gets out of hospital. I remember thinking, good, she's better. I had no idea that there was a long... Fast forward another couple of years, she's still very sick. In fact, I remember getting home that night.
Come on, Patrick.
Blame Qantas, Terry.
We're blaming Qantas.
How are you?
I'm good. Very good.
I was just telling him I'm very excited to meet you. So.
Oh, you too, yeah.
I don't have posters on my wall anymore. I used to when I was a kid. If I did, it'd probably be my wall.
So we're talking about your sister's...
Yeah, I remember, I was just telling a story of my sister when she was quite sick. But I remember I got home from hospital that night and we were having dinner as a family, and Dad got up and he went to the kitchen to do the washing up. And I remember I asked him a question, he didn't answer. So I asked him again and he didn't answer, and I turned around and I'll never forget the silhouette of my dad hunched over the kitchen sink in tears. I was 21 years old, I'd never seen him cry before. And I think that's when I understood for the first time in my life how serious mental illness is. But I guess it's also the time of my life when I became really fascinated with the question, what is it that makes people happy? I knew I couldn't fix my sister. That was well beyond me. That's for people much smarter than I. But I did want to know what I could do to maybe help Mum and Dad smile a bit more. and my little brother Josh as well. So I guess that's where my very long story for you, but that's where my journey started.
Yeah, and, but it was about trying to make people happy who were sad.
I think so, very naively and very...
By being funny.
I think so.
Trying to make people laugh.
Well, I sort of, yeah, all I knew to do back then was just to tell stories to make mum and dad laugh. I love making them laugh, and I'd tell these wildly embellished stories just to get a laugh out of them at the dinner table, and that was sort of all I knew for quite some time.
So what motivated you to become a primary school teacher, and what focused your attention in the classroom?
I just remember thinking, oh, if I become a primary school teacher, I could stop the kids in my class getting a mental illness. And that was, I don't know how I was going to do it, but I thought, I'll do that. And then, I did this whole degree, and I was disappointed but also shocked that at no point in my education as a primary school teacher was there anything on mental health. I did a whole year on tessellations, like shapes that, and I did a whole year, I don't know how to define it, but it's like this, anyway, it doesn't matter. You guys know what it is, you're smarter than I. So, but nothing on mental health. And I remember being really disappointed by that. So my first day as a primary school teacher, I remember sitting there, 25 young kids, grade five kids, I remember sitting there going, right, how do I stop them getting a mental illness? And it always kind of really fascinated me. And again, I had no real strategies. I looked for stuff. There wasn't much. It was in 2004, I think it was. And I never felt like I really had anything practical to sort of give them. And when I found stuff, the school I was teaching at said, your job is literacy and numeracy.
Yeah.
And we wouldn't have time in the curriculum for this kind of stuff.
So where did your instinct take you?
Well, I'd love to say my instinct because it makes me sound really cool, but it was my ex-girlfriend who said we should go to India, and I didn't want to go, but she, well, yeah, I won't go too far into it, but we went.
You went to India.
Yeah, we went to India. Yeah, and while we're there, I said we should do some teaching because we had no money at the time, and she said we should volunteer, and I said, well, do you know what, we could teach, we could get paid, and we could still have the same effect, and because she's a wonderful person. Well, she still is, I believe, a wonderful person. But she said to me, we've got to volunteer. We found a community, no running water, no electricity, no beds. Everyone sleeps on the floor. I remember my first night saying to her, I can't, there's no way I can do 2 weeks of this. My next day was the first day in the school, and I remember sitting there half an hour in a mud hut in the middle of the desert in the Himalayas. In the middle of the desert, I remember sitting there just thinking, looking at these kids thinking, I've never seen joy like this before. I've never seen anything like it. 2 weeks turned into 3.5 months. I decided on our last night, I thought, you know what, I can't leave here. I need to leave here. I want to leave here as long as it takes me to work out. What are these people doing every day? I still have never seen joy like it. Not to say everyone in... It was just this small village. And so I lived there and I watched what those people did, and I joined in with everything they were doing. A profound impact on me. But I remember thinking... On the plane on the way back, I was 28, a little bit sceptical. I thought, but this has helped a happy person to feel a lot happier. That's not what I'm interested in. I want to know if it's going to help someone like my sister. So I just went back to uni, did my postgrad studies and looked at the research behind the things that I saw, and saw there was a lot of research screaming at us that these things can have a really big impact as preventative measures for young people. And so that's...
So where did you take that? What did you do with that?
Well, we were discussing this on the phone the other day. I was teaching a group of year 12s at the time who had been... In and out of juvie, though, some of the kids had been expelled and couldn't get back into mainstream schooling. So with this group, it was a really challenging year. And about 3 or 4 weeks in, I thought I might try and implement. I mean, the things that I saw over there, I saw this community practice gratitude every day. They practice mindfulness every day. The most empathetic community I've ever seen. And so I started doing these things with these kids, these boys in this program in Melbourne. And I couldn't believe what I was seeing. I was just blown away by the impact it was having on these kids.
So you said empathy. How were you communicating empathy to those kids?
Well, to me, I was modelling it. A lot of the time, I started modelling it. And I remember we talked about how... I just remember... I don't know why I remember this. It's 2010, but I remember the conversation where I talked about... I'd been studying the night before, everything I was learning at my postgrad, and I just said to them, the research says the more empathetic you are, the more likely you are to act in a kind way. And then the neuroscience behind kindness is fascinating. It's like when you do something for someone else, your brain releases oxytocin. That's a feel-good hormone. Now, this isn't the thing that fixes mental ill health. It's just helps you feel a bit happier and improves mood. And And so I just said, let's start practicing that. And we had these rolling acts of kindness, and people had to do something.
Rolling acts of kindness.
Yeah. So someone would do something for someone else in the class, and they had to do something else, something genuine, heartfelt.
But it wasn't open necessarily.
No. And
you weren't sort of sticking your chest out when you managed to do something kind towards someone else.
And it wasn't so you'd get something in return either. It was, and we did these letters. You had to write letters to the people that were really special in their life and tell them why they love them. Something simple like that, something these boys had never really done before, and it's quite difficult. But I just watched the things like their body language just sort of change when I saw them, you know, writing it. And some of them read them out to the class, and these boys in tears, and it was very special. And so that's, I guess, where my instinct kind of took me.
And mindfulness, you would take them out for a walk, maybe around the block or around a field, and you would ask them to notice five or ten things.
I mean, I'm fascinated on Patrick's take on mindfulness. I mean, for me...
I know what his take is. You're not necessarily going to like it, but go on.
Okay. I'm pretty sure I will. I think I will. Look, for me, and I... For me, mindfulness, from my experience of it, having attempted it for a long time and having long discussions with my father-in-law, who's Professor Rob Moody, who's Professor of Public Health at Melbourne, long discussions with him, who... big advocate and has done Vipassana. And for me, I've found the just being, the ability to be wherever I am, I guess, or just to be wherever I am. And that's something that when I got these kids, I just said, getting them to meditate was very difficult. So I said, let's walk a lap of the block and I want you to pay attention to what you can hear. And every time your mind thinks about something that's happening tomorrow or happened yesterday, just bring it back to what you can hear. And that might not be specifically meditation per se, but I did find that four things that, you know, that I was reading about and I was watching in these boys was that they might have become more mindful that day or that week, but their ability to concentrate improved, their clarity of thought improved, equanimity, the ability to kind of let go of things that we're carrying way too much at the moment. I feel like someone cuts us off in traffic, we get so angry about it for a long time instead of going... They could be on the way to a job interview. If that's the case, I really hope they get there in time, you know, they're letting go. And then I think care as well, their ability to care for each other kind of improved when they were more present, I guess.
So then, of course, you've got to sustain that. But I want to come to the present now. Tell me about the Resilience Project and what has been learned from it about child and adolescent mental health in your terms. How do you... I mean, what have been your achievements? Just give me some stats on the numbers that have gone through programs and what the shape of the programs are.
I'll have to check. I think it's around 500,000 kids around Australia. Next year we'll be doing our curriculum and doing our program around mainly state schools all over Australia, which I'm really excited about for the simple fact that Adelaide University completed their three-year evaluation of our program, and I didn't know this was happening, and they said, there's a lot of people doing this program, what's the evidence that it works? And I said, oh, we get some lovely emails from teachers. And they said, oh, that's great, but what's the evidence? And I said, yeah, well, and they said, we'd love to do it. And they said, to find out if it's actually working, which made me extremely nervous.
How many people?
So what they did was they found they got 80,000 kids doing our program over the last 3 years and compared to 80,000 kids not doing our program. And what they found was, and not a huge surprise, but the 80,000 kids in schools who are not doing our program, during 2020, when I'm saying this, not a surprise, in 2020, not a surprise, there was a sharp increase in symptoms of depression
pandemic
and anxiety and feelings of hope and life satisfaction went down. What they found was, which I shouldn't be shocked about, but I was and very relieved and also very happy that there was no increase in symptoms of depression and anxiety for the kids doing our program, and also feelings of hope and life satisfaction went up in 2020, which was... it took me a while to kind of... Yeah, I was quite proud of that. I don't often say that about things that I do, but I felt quite proud of that. So it makes me happy that there are 500,000 kids doing this.
Okay, and it's not just the kids, is it? I mean, the teachers would be critical to this.
A big part of it is training the teachers. I think that's more than half the battle.
And what's the response been with the teachers, broadly?
Really, really good. I mean, I started off going and speaking in schools to I'd go and speak to a staff, and I would see, you could, I mean, there's 30 teachers in it. I could actually see who was into it, who wasn't, who was sceptical, who was being changing their mind during it. And so I've lived that for 12 years, and now when they start teaching, they see what it's doing for their kids, but also for themselves. It's a lovely resource for the teachers themselves. So I think teachers are half the battle, and when you get them, which we seem to do, our content for teachers, I think, is quite good. They become the champions for it, and yeah, they really sort of drive it within the school, and then they drive the program to the parents, because there's a lot of stuff for parents there as well, because it's all very well there.
So to what extent have you been able to? What time has it taken you to build the program to what it is now? You're saying you're going to be covering 500,000 kids next year. How long has it taken you to get to that from when you started walking down this track as a project?
My first presentation was in a school 13 years ago, and to a staff, and one of the teachers came up to me and said, "How long is this going to go for?" And I said, "An hour." And he said, "Do it in half an hour, would you?" And I went, "Okay." Which was kind of like a nice, I mean, it wasn't nice, it was the opposite of nice, but I remember thinking that it was a good introduction to what the attitude was to this topic 13 years ago. So it's 13 years, I think, of... I haven't practiced what I preach. I've been burnt out on many occasions, and I've only just recently started to. I mean, mainly because I've got 3 kids under the age of 6, but I've started to. Which, by the way, I'm so excited to be in the Gold Coast tonight.
I'm there in Melbourne.
Yeah, my wife Penny said this morning. Yesterday she said, "You're the Gold Coast for a night." I said, "Yeah, I am." And she said, "We could come." And I went, I don't know this. What was I saying? I can't remember.
What I'm trying to gauge is if this is such a successful program, it obviously, to be really effective, I would imagine, there's got to be a consistent stream of this going through a kid's school years. If you get a kid in grade 2 or 3 or 4 or 5, and then that's the end of it.
Yeah.
So presumably the program ultimately is going to follow kids right through school. I don't mean round the clock. But
yeah, I mean, we've got an incredible early learning years team, or kinder team, so who have put together our kinder curriculum. We've got all the way through to year 12. The team have put together our program for year 12s. They're incredible educators and psychologists. And the dream for us is that we get kids going all the way through. I mean, there are some great programs out there, I've got to say. I certainly don't think everyone should be doing our program. Well, there's some wonderful stuff out there. It's just desperately needed. Having been a teacher and been a teacher for 8 years and seeing how desperately we need to be prioritising mental health, there are some wonderful programs. Not for a second am I saying everyone do ours, because I don't think that's...
So, Patrick, before we start down the road with your story, what's your reaction as you hear Hugh's story?
It's pretty positive, Kerry. I mean, obviously, what I understand what Hugh's doing is under the positive psychology mental health promotion umbrella. Would that be right?
I think we've taken a bit of influence from there. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Not strictly positive psychology, but definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's about mental health. I don't think it's about mental ill health or mental illness, actually.
Yep.
So it's very complementary. Everyone needs positive mental health and well-being, including people with serious mental illness. So, and that's possible to improve, their mental health, even if they've got, ironically, a serious mental illness. So I think it's pretty positive. And I can't see why it couldn't be. I mean, something like that should be part of all schools, really. But it's not going to solve the problem that Hugh identified.
No,
I was trying to start in the first place, like preventing mental illness.
But it might be a part of the picture.
Yeah, definitely.
In terms of the education process, not just with the kids, but with educators, with parents, and so on.
So let's
talk about you. You've been in psychiatry for 40 years. I'd like you to paint a brief picture of the nature of the profession you entered back in 1981, and the way mental health was treated back then.
Yeah, great. Well, actually, listening to Hugh is at the same starting point. Saw people with serious mental illness getting an incredibly raw deal, with no hope or optimism for their futures, treated in a 19th century model of care, the old asylum system, and that's where I started training. And I put off doing that. I think I told you that the other day. I put off for 4 years training in psychiatry because I didn't want to be part of a system like that, actually. But then, you know, I was inspired to give it a go by a woman called Beverly Raphael, who was a professor of psychiatry in Newcastle, where I was living, and she exuded positivity, a bit like you, you know, like a sort of a compassionate warmth, which was rare amongst psychiatrists, actually, at that time anyway. So she had, a recovery and prevention sort of mindset, actually, which was missing from psychiatry, absolutely, totally missing, and it's still a battle to kind of keep that flame, you know, spreading within the mental health field because of the sort of heavy pessimism that is associated with and neglect by governments and by the community of the care of the mentally ill still. Yeah, the optimism is hard to sort of really, you know, nurture and spread. You know, so in that case, I've got, in that way, I've got a common bond, I think, with what Hugh's saying about, you know, having an optimistic and hopeful approach to things.
But in a couple of sentences, how would you summarise the way psychiatrists went about their practice 40 years ago?
Okay, well, maybe I'll just give a little story. I mean, I remember, you know, when I was training, being exposed to not just psychiatrists but nurses, everybody telling young people coming in with their first psychotic episode. I was very interested in schizophrenia and that whole, you know, group of illnesses. And they would be told, I'm really sorry, but you've got schizophrenia and you will never recover. You'll probably never get married. You probably won't work. And really, you've got to get used to, you know, a deteriorating or declining life. And if you read papers about schizophrenia, even these days in the scientific literature, it will say schizophrenia is a devastating illness which causes chronic inevitable disability. I mean, that sort of language and mindset is still there, even though we've got all the evidence to show that's not necessarily the case, especially with early treatment.
And what drives that?
Well, two things, I think. One is the original conception of schizophrenia in the 19th century, which was like as an analogue of a dementia, of a type of dementia in young people, dementia praecox it was called originally. And the second thing is the clinician's illusion, which creates the impression that is the case, you know, because the neglect of services, you know, the fact that people get patched up and kicked back out again without proper ongoing care, even if they've got quite well, and the fact that most clinicians work in chronic mental health settings and that's all they see. They don't see the people who have got better. They certainly don't work in oases of care where a lot of people get better and stay well if they're looked after properly. So it's like an illusion of severity. It's not to say these aren't serious illnesses, but they don't see the what can be achieved with positive environments and positive care.
Look, my impression as a journalist over the years is that there are not a lot of psychiatrists you go to if you want to talk about reform of mental health.
Yeah.
There's you. There's
Ian Hickey.
Hickey.
Yeah.
In Sydney. Now, there must be others out there somewhere, but that, you know, I don't know how many psychiatrists there are in Australia, but that's an extraordinary impression to have about your industry.
Yeah, well, I think that's right. I think you've got to remember that we are pretty low in the pecking order, you know, even though we're perceived as, you know, by some people as powerful. Actually, you're completely disempowered working in the health system as a public sector psychiatrist. You're down the pecking order in these mainstream health systems.
Why is that? You're asking questions, but sorry.
Yeah.
Continue.
Ask your father-in-law.
Yeah, sorry.
I mean, we are looked down upon by other medical specialists. We've been the managerial approach to mental health care is more extreme than other medical specialties. So psychiatrists are wheeled in to take all the risk and responsibility, and then wheeled back out again. Confined.
Is that because behind it is the unspoken belief that there's not much you can do about them?
Yeah, I think that's a key part of it. And stigma, there's this concept of systemic stigma. In the NHMRC, for example, it's rife in terms of whether we get a fair go
in medical research Council.
Yes.
Where all the medical research is done.
That's right.
It is ticked off.
So cancer is right up there, immunology is right up there. Even though our metrics are better than those specialties in international publishing and impact, we're seen, and I've heard this said, as underperforming compared to these wonderful specialists in cancer and immunology and public health.
Yeah. Can you briefly...
I'm not bitter, by the way.
So in your 40 years, before I get a brief explanation from you of what you're doing with Origin, with Headspace now, and why that is different. Mm. But what is your sense of the state of mental health or mental illness in Australia today compared to even 5-10 years ago?
Well, I think...
What's happening with mental
health? One of the positives you would think has been this opening up, you know, the fact that we have nights like tonight and Hugh is talking about what he's doing. So the awareness and... it's top of mind, and if you talk to the public, any member of the public, it's top of mind for them. Talk to any politician, it's top of mind. But there's a bit of a missing piece between that awareness and that positivity in that sense and real reform, coming back to your point. So there has been progress, and I think Australia is the most innovative country in the world for coming up with new ideas of various kinds and implementing them up to a point, but it's just not prioritised enough. And I use the example of the NDIS. Like 12 years ago, there was a choice that the Gillard government had between which way to go, three options actually, really nail physical disability, really nail mental health, try to do both in a serious way. They went with the NDIS and it's now costing $30 billion a year. Mental health care costs $10 billion a year for an issue that's 10 times as common. And much more impactful on the Australian public. So that's the sort of decision-making that we needed to have and we still need to have, especially post-pandemic, affirmative action for a very neglected public health area. Yeah.
Mm. And what is your picture of what's going on with young people in Australia today and mental illness? And, I mean, is it on the rise?
Well, we have a thing called the National Mental Health Survey, which the ABS does... periodically. It's every 15 years currently. It should be every at least 5 years, but they did one in 2007 which showed that young people, teenagers, young adults, had 26% of them in a given year were diagnosable with a mental health condition. So that's one in four. It's the highest level across the whole lifespan. It was done again in 2021 and something like 39% of young people were diagnosable. That's a 50% rise over that period of time, and it was happening before COVID and the pandemic. It's been happening in other countries like the US. So coming back to what Hugh was on about to start off with, we've got to find a way to understand why that is such a rapidly deteriorating situation in young people. It's got to be to do with mega trends in society. When you're talking about Nepal, I guess you were talking about, what is it about our society that's become so toxic for young people? Mm. And it's got to be these mega trends that are happening in the society. So we've got to help these young people. We've got hundreds or thousands of these young people on waiting lists to be seen as a result of that. But we've got to turn off the tap as well. We've got to understand how to turn off the tap, and that's resonating a little bit with some of the things that Hugh was saying.
Yeah. So just quickly, what are you trying to achieve in your own work? What are you doing that's different? And you kind of pushed against the grain, didn't you, in arguing so strongly for early intervention?
Yeah, and I've had a lot of pushback from a small group of academic psychiatrists that keep writing the same article in the journal saying it doesn't work.
But the evidence has grown
elsewhere. The evidence is really strong now, even in the more serious conditions like schizophrenia. So what I'm trying to do, not just me, but my whole army of colleagues and friends and... what we're trying to do is build a new system of care for young people. Basically, you mentioned Headspace, that's the primary care, that's the entry level, welcoming, sort of friendly, youth friendly type, co-designed with young people, entry portal with a number of basic needs being addressed at the primary care level. The next tier, which we're trying really hard to get Mark Butler to continue building, he started building it about 10 years ago in the Gillard government. That's the good thing that he really did at that point, building this backup system, which is to absorb this missing middle, this next tier of young people that don't get better just with a sort of a light touch primary care model. And then the final tier is really what the state governments tend to provide, the more severe end and the acute end, and try to integrate all those things vertically so the young person and the family don't notice which government's involved and they can just flow through up and down as they need it. And also being perhaps surrounded by the mental health, healthy mindset that you were talking about, the well-being mindset.
And one of the things that you have battered your head against the wall over many years, because I can remember us talking about it, it's got to be 15 years ago. And that is that somebody comes to the attention of the mental health system. They collapse in some way. They need critical care in some way. They go into a hospital. They might be in a hospital overnight. They might be in a hospital for a week or 2 weeks. There might be some improvement, some slight improvement. Mm. They're spat out of the hospital system to make way for somebody else in the hope that they're going to be picked up by the supposed community support networks that are out there to pick them up and maintain contact and care. But as often as not, they're missed, right?
Yeah. Well, if you just look at what happened in the world, when these 19th century models were dismantled, you know, about 20, 30 years ago, the proposition was we'll mainstream mental health care in the mainstream health system, whether it's in general practice or it's in acute hospitals, and you won't need all these beds that we're closing. You'll only need a few beds because we're going to build a really strong, caring, multidisciplinary platform of care in the community that which will look after these people. They won't need to go into hospital very much. So they did the first thing. They closed all the beds and built some jerry-built new beds in the mainstream hospital system, which are now falling apart, by the way, in Victoria at least. But they completely failed to build at scale the community-based system to absorb that, like a sponge, all of that unmet need in the community and prevent it ending up in acute care. So,
and this was with much lower numbers than you have today.
Yeah, and then you've got population growth and the fact that the numbers are going up and that also because of the awareness, people are actually seeking help, you know, which is great, you know. But trouble is, you know, you can't get in until you're really severely ill. Then you get revolving door, kicked out by the ED or by the acute unit. And there are horror stories that we had a Royal Commission in Victoria because of this collapse of this system, which actually came up with a great blueprint and is trying to execute that blueprint. But I can tell you, like 2 weeks ago, a really good friend of mine, her niece, basically in a regional hospital in Victoria, presented for probably the umpteenth time to the ED, hit the revolving door, walked out, hanged herself on the railings across the street. And that is still happening. And the kind of the self-harm sort of wave of people coming in, that they're not taken seriously, that they're treated as a nuisance by the system. And that's how they're felt by that system. That's the reaction she got, and she's dead.
So let's talk now about what is going on that's causing this very significant uptake in numbers of mental illness. And I mean, this is to both of you, and I realise you're not seeing actual mental illness in the same way that Patrick is, but nonetheless, I think some of the causes of you are in a position to observe some of the causes in progress. So, Patrick, first of all, what are the most common types of mental illness amongst children, adolescents and young adults?
Well, we've tried to create two zones, and the Victorian government's supporting this. One is the 0 to 11, you know, the early childhood and then the primary school years, partly because of developmental reasons. Obviously, they're different. Little kids pre-pubertal are different in the way they are developmentally, but also the kinds of conditions that they present with from a mental ill health point of view are different. So their autism spectrum, their ADHD, their conduct disorder, their anxiety, so there's different constellation of... So different skills, also different teams are needed, you know, to treat them, like paediatricians are important and other groups. And they because they're little kids, the parents can bring them. When you're dealing with emerging adults, as we say, from puberty onwards, it's a different ballgame. You know, it's much more challenging. You have to involve the young people in co-design and it's a very positive thing to do that. The culture of care has to be different. You know, it has to be acceptable to the young person to actually... go into that culture. If it's designed for little kids, which is most of the CAM services are like that, or for older adults, middle-aged people, basically, they don't fit and they don't feel comfortable and the skill sets are not there developmentally or in terms of early intervention to help them make the maximum recovery. So we're trying to create those two zones. Once puberty kicks in, you start to see the adult-type conditions emerging, like depression, like psychosis, like anorexia, like personality, borderline personality, substance use. And you get these constellations of or comorbidity. You get mixtures of these things appearing. And so you need a different type of expertise and also, I think, resilience to actually work with that group of patients because it's very, very difficult. It takes a bit of a gift to work with that emerging adult group. You've got to really like them and you've got to have affinity with them to really be successful in working with them.
Yeah. Is it accurate to talk about an epidemic of anxiety disorders? Because... and the media... is deeply imperfect, Patrick, as you've probably worked out over the years in how it reports mental illness. Mm. But there is a sense that that permeating through young people growing is this thread of anxiety at different levels and different intensity. I mean, this social anxiety, separation anxiety, panic disorder, phobias, anxiety resulting from trauma like domestic violence at home. Mm. Are there common elements that you look for when you're looking at that spread of disorders? Is there a common element behind it that's causing the anxiety in the first place?
I'm not sure about the cause because there are these candidates, you know, which we can talk about climate change and, you know, social media, all those sorts of things. But anxiety, I've learned a lot since I started working in the primary care, the frontline area of headspace over the last 15 years. I've seen things I never saw working in more specialised settings, and the early stages of any problem start with anxiety, in my experience now. Anxiety leads into other conditions like depression or substance use or psychosis. It's a precursor sort of, it's a warning sign. In itself, it can be incredibly disabling. There are kids, I think I told you on the phone, who've got such severe anxiety, we have to go to them. We have to leave the headspace and go to their home because they can't come in, or we have to do it on telehealth because they're paralysed by the anxiety. So that's even in primary care. So anxiety is like a gateway to everything else, I think. Yeah.
How is this resonating from your experience? Yeah,
I'm just very much enjoying listening to Patrick, to be honest. we had a psychologist on our podcast recently and she said the exact same thing around anxiety. She said, for me, anxiety is this irrational concern, and then there's a point, you know, if it goes to depression where the child or the adolescent will say, I'll give up. And then that's when it's too much, and that's when they give in and then there's depression. I can't help but, and I'm sure there's a lot of research on this. Actually, I don't know if there is, but for me, I'm so fascinated with the role that our devices and our smartphones and social media are playing on the impact on our mental health. That I find fascinating. I don't know about... I mean, I'm 42. I remember when I got my first mobile phone, I was 21, 22. Social media didn't come around until I was 28, 29. I am so unbelievably grateful I grew up before devices and before social media, because as an adult, I find it anxiety-inducing, being on social media. And I speak to so many parents who are terrified about the impact it's having on their kids and the impact it's having on, you know, things like social skills. But, you know, when my sister was growing up, she was a subscriber to Dolly magazine. Was it Dolly magazine? Dolly was, that's it. Yeah, you said that very quickly.
Yep. I did. I've got two daughters.
Okay, good. And she would get a magazine every month, and in that magazine there might be 50 pictures of girls that she would compare herself to. Girls are seeing 50 other girls in 50 seconds now as they scroll through their newsfeed, and it's not models that they're... I mean, my sister, and there was like these are models, this is their job to look really good. They're looking at pictures of their peers and their friends who are curating the absolute best version of themselves.
And they might have, for a single picture, they might have taken 50 or 100.
Well, the girl staying in the hotel on the balcony across from me did take about 100 just before I came here. It was quite a process. It was exactly what you were talking about. That makes it sound very creepy, like I was watching her. I just noticed.
I just noticed that.
We cut that bit out. That'd be great. But but my sister wouldn't have... I mean, she struggled back then, but she wouldn't have stood a chance now, like looking at with the infant. So I don't know. I mean, that really worries me, devices, social media, and addiction, I feel like, has got a lot worse as a result of the pandemic because we're so just desperate to connect somewhere. We sort of... And I feel like what's on social media now is so much more addictive than what it was 4 or 5 years ago. I mean, you look at the difference between... I mean, TikTok is so much more... so much more addictive than Facebook is. And I've heard the next iteration in, 5 to 10 years' time will be just as addictive as the difference between Facebook and TikTok. So... Yeah. That really scares me because I feel like we're a little bit powerless in how we deal with this. The big tech companies need to let us go, like treat us with a little bit more care and have a design that is set up to... I mean, right now, I think social media is set up to capture our attention and sell it to the highest bidder, essentially. I think social media, we could still be on it as much, but it could be... The design could be a little bit different. It could be... capture our attention and help us to become the best or the version of ourselves we want to be. If we want to be more, if we want to be fitter, send us gently in that direction rather than sell our attention at any cost. So I don't think I haven't answered your question.
Of course it's. I mean, this is a very the link has to be there. It's just a question of how much of the whole picture you can relate to social media. But when you talk about the explosion in mental illness in the young. You're really talking about Generation Z and the so-called digital natives, as they are, who've been raised with a mobile phone in their pre-adolescent hand often. And that is a pretty powerful link to social media as a cause, isn't it?
Yeah, well, there's actually a book just been written called Generations this year by Professor Duffy from the King's College London Policy Institute. And he's pushing back a little bit against, different generations being worse than the one before. He's trying to say that each generation they've got a lot more in common with the previous one than they have differences. But nevertheless, there are differences. And he does talk about social media in the way that Hugh was talking about. So it's got to be something seriously looked at as a mega trend or risk factor that's got a lot of potential for harm as well as good. We try to use internet and digital sort of strategies as a complementary thing for recovery and treatment. So Murray Alvarez, our professor in Origin Digital, has developed this amazing platform called MOST, which is being rolled out across the youth mental health services in Queensland, New South Wales, ACT and Victoria. So it's a complementary thing. And there's another thing called ChatSafe, which allows young people... Joe Robinson, my colleague, developed that as a way of helping young people talk about suicide safely online. So there are mitigating things that can be done because it's a reality now, this whole dimension of young people's lives or our lives as well. But then not much is being done about the harm side of it. I don't think these... I don't know if you saw the ABC thing about the big health check that Magda Zabinski... Yeah. So they focus a lot on food and food companies, the big food companies as a harmful influence on society. Well, the big tech companies must be seen in the same light, I would have thought.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, I wonder whether the kind of... the way we measure our norms today, when you are diagnosing a mental illness, and let's say it's an anxiety disorder, you are measuring, this is my lay terms, Patrick, but you are measuring whether that really is a disorder or not, perhaps on the basis of whether it has destroyed the functionality of the person. But you are making a measure of an abnormal behaviour against the norm. But haven't the norms changed? I mean, aren't we now such a success-driven society? Everything's got to be a measure of success, and whether it's at the NAPLAN at school, whether the increasing emphasis that seems to have gone onto the HSC and that whole kind of syndrome in the workplace now, I was staggered to hear recently that we've come to accept the KPI as part of the language of the corporate world. Where companies' KPIs have to be met, where the heads of a department's KPIs have to be met. But I'm now hearing stories about how individuals' KPIs in the workplace have to be met as a measure of work. I just wonder whether that kind of success-driven model that I think is a part of our lives, anecdotally, is that a feature? Is that a factor?
Well, this is an incredibly important issue to grapple with. The Griffith Review published a thing called States of Mind. I think it was last year. I wrote a piece, and I spent a fair bit of time writing about this boundary between normality and need for care, you know, because, you know, a lot of the idea of intervening early before things get really severe, you get into that territory where people will say, well, you're just, what are you doing? You're labelling the human condition. You're sort of doing something, you're overreaching here. It's just life, you know. But actually, you've got to have a bit of a fuzzy boundary there, and you have to allow the person to define when they want to seek help too, you know. So it really should be in the hands of the young person to say, look, I actually need help. And what would be the reasons for needing help? One would be distress, which, if you saw all the surveys of young people through the pandemic, intense distress in young people, much higher levels than pre-pandemic. So distress is one parameter. And then duration of that distress or that sort of those change experiences would be another. And the final one you mentioned is functionality. If people are really struggling, they can't go outside the house, or they can't relate to their friends or their peer group, or they're dropping off their normal developmental pathways, that's another thing that they and their parents would be pretty worried about, which is pretty normal. And you don't have to be picking up the DSM and ticking off all the criteria to work out that person needs help. And so when you actually are at that front, that beginning stage of needing help, it doesn't look like a textbook. It doesn't look like a DSM or a psychiatric textbook. It looks like something a lot more amorphous, and therefore something that's capable of recovery much more easily, I think, you know. So that's the way I think about it anyway. And you have to have that open door, really, for allowing people to sort of talk to someone. It doesn't have to necessarily be a super specialist, but just talk to someone about what's happening to them.
But don't we then come back to another continuing fundamental problem? Mm. We simply don't have enough mental health practitioners to meet the demand.
Yeah.
So even with your with Headspace, the people who are able to access Headspace, are they able to easily be accommodated for follow-up visits? I mean, are they going to be able to see their practitioner every couple of weeks for as long as it takes? Or
no, Headspace is overwhelmed with demand now with that rise. And I mean, there's a lot of defeatism. You know, I had a meeting in Canberra yesterday, actually, and there's a lot of defeatism saying we'll never have enough mental health professionals. Well, would we say that if it was cancer or diabetes? Would we just give up like that? Would we give up? No, we wouldn't.
No.
But on the other hand, we can complement and we can work smarter. So we can involve young people as peer workers. We can involve volunteers. We can build in some of the things that Hugh's been talking about as well. There's a thing called the Friendship Bench in Zimbabwe, where they had grandmothers just as the first port of call, sitting in the town square, and people could go up and just talk to them, and then they might then be the kind of gatekeeper or the baton passer to the next level, assuming there is a next level. But for us to just say, look, you know, we can only provide care for half the people in Australia, one of the richest countries in the world, who need mental health care, that's just giving up. You know,
you understand how, let's say, psychology, how a community like the Gold Coast, people needing seriously needing the care or access to a psychologist might have to wait 6 or 12 months, in most other communities around Australia. How does it get to that?
Well, because there's no sense of urgency. Like, we've got a government in Victoria which is very motivated to rebuild the public mental health system. They had a royal commission. The premier said the system's broken. The only honest politician in mental health I've ever heard, you know, say the system's broken, and prepared to rebuild it. But then it's going to take four to 10 years. But you wouldn't say that if it was COVID. You wouldn't say that if it was, you know, breast cancer. Why don't we have a sense of urgency about that?
We certainly saw what we're capable of during COVID as far as a response to a health crisis. And there's no question this is absolutely a health crisis.
And the federal government put the queue in the rack. I mean, you know, Prime Minister agreed that Scott Morrison had done quite a good job with mental health, so nothing more to see here. And so why isn't it a priority post-pandemic? It's the second wave of the pandemic, the shadow pandemic. Why isn't it one of the rebuilding priorities for this government now?
Yes, well, we don't have anyone here who's going to answer that.
It's a rhetorical question.
Well, it's a fundamental question. Patrick, you mentioned resilience. Hugh, your resilience is a kind of foundational core, isn't it, of your whole therapeutic approach. But what do you mean by it?
Because
it can so easily, resilience can so easily be turned into suck it up or toughen up.
Yeah, which I think a few decades ago that was a common thing to kind of hear. I don't think there's too much of that anymore. It's funny, I've even noticed myself recently using the word coping more than resilience. I feel like, especially off the back of the pandemic, I feel like a lot of people are saying, well, I just want to cope for now. Yeah, I'll try and be stronger again and I'll hopefully be stronger than what I was because of what I went through. But now I just want to try and cope. And, the word resilience for me, I like it because I think it's very aspirational. I think it's a nice, especially at a time like this, but realistically I think a lot of people are just, they're just putting their head down and just trying to cope. Is my honest response, yeah. I'm not going to change it to the coping project. It doesn't sound as cool, but...
I mean, you're almost sort of writing off the importance of the meaning of that word in your own thinking, in your whole approach.
No, that's just how I feel at the moment.
What is the resilience that a kid gets from what you practice in classrooms?
Well, I hope what they get... I mean, not every single child is going to do our program and go, bang, I'm resilient as a result. I'll rephrase that. For the first couple of years of my son's life, people used to say to me, what do you want most for your kids? Or what do you want most for your son? And my answer for the first couple of years, I just wanted him to be happy. But I've realised very quickly that is such an unrealistic expectation. He's not always going to be happy. You're far from it. And I've realised what I want really is for him to, when something goes wrong in his life, I want him to have some resources and tools at his disposal that he can go to help him get through whatever it is. And that's kind of what we hope to provide to kids who are using our program. Here are some resources, and exactly what Patrick said, this is not going to fix the issue, but here are some resources that might help you along your journey, because hopefully it's not this year, it may not be till your secondary school, it may not be into your 20s or 30s, but something will go wrong at some point. And here's some of the things you can do to help you to bounce back. And in some cases, with the right cultural support around it, well, cultural support's the wrong word, but just, with the right environment and community around them, that they'll also become stronger than what they were as a result of what they went through. I guess that's kind of what we're going. But the reason I went to coping before is that's just how I feel right now. After a really tough couple of years in Melbourne, we got out of lockdown last year for, I don't know, it was 45 minutes or something last year. And we're still, I think a lot of people in Melbourne still have this, it's like, God, what on earth have we just been through? We're still sort of trying to come to terms with what's just happened. We're going through some stuff at home with one of our kids that we're sort of has taken up all our time and focus and our energy. And for me right now, that's a personal answer about for me. I'm just trying to cope. But still, we still absolutely aspire towards resilience with everything that we do.
So what is resilience for you? I mean, how do you encourage resilience or develop resilience in a seriously traumatised child?
Well, I think
or young adult.
What occurred to me listening to Hugh then was there's a philosopher called Joseph Campbell, and he came up with this monomyth, which was in all cultures, and it's called the hero's journey. I don't know if you've heard, you probably know all about that. So I think resilience fits into that. This is the idea that, every person is living a hero's journey, especially in this transition to adult life when you're trying to work out who you are and all those sort of things. So you've got to come up against major obstacles, whether they're developmental or just life, curveballs or whatever they are. And so what do you need to get through it? One is hope, I think, and a belief that it is a journey. Second is support, like support from other people. Coping would be another one, learning coping. And it's a reframe of what people actually go through, and it's also acknowledging that life is stressful, and it's going to really sort of, there are going to be periods when you go through dark times. So resilience could be thought of in that sort of concept or that scenario as an outcome as much as something that as an input, if you know what I mean. I think Julia Gillard described resilience as a byproduct of challenges in life rather than something that you inject at the front end. So yeah. I don't know, what do you think about that idea?
It's a bit of a strange response, but I can't help but think about Luke Skywalker.
Well, that's right.
Luke Skywalker went through the hero's journey. Anyway, I won't go into Star Wars analysis, but that's what I think of. I love the hero's journey. I think it's, a very aspirational thing. I think when you're going through a tough time, it's also a reminder that this is life. This is part of life, and it's hard right now.
And it's okay to help people. You know, like this is where we come in as the helping professions. I mean, to say that it's some kind of weakness if you need help, that's been another thing that's undermined what we offer in mental health care.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I mean, we haven't really talked much about teachers here. That was where you started, and you are working with teachers now. But the poor old teachers carry so much responsibility, and a lot of that responsibility is sort of put on them by a lot of parents who are very busy in their own lives or are barely coping in their own lives and hoping that. So there's this whole sort of. There are all these layers in the process, aren't there? Where does resilience for teachers come in? Where, when you're going into those schools and you're helping teachers to actually to maybe embrace what you believe in as a therapy for the kids, but who's providing the therapy for the teachers?
Yeah, well, it's a great question. There are some schools we work with who have psychologists there for the kids that the teachers can also access, and I think that's a wonderful service. When we talk to teachers a lot, I think one of the challenges, I mean, one of the most powerful ways to influence a young person's behaviour is to model the behaviours. And so there's a really big challenge for teachers over the last couple of years to try and model resilience in front of their kids who are also struggling. A lot of it was, albeit over a screen, but I had a lot of conversations with principals over the last couple of years about, I think one of the things you can model right now is, as teachers, is you can let the kids in a little bit and talk about, you'll be a little bit vulnerable and say, here's what I'm struggling with right now. So the kids know that it's all right to struggle. Like, it's okay because here's the person I look up to the most, my teacher. And there's no better person to learn from than your teacher, that it's okay to not be okay all the time. Yeah. And so I think a lot of the work we did last year was sort of helping teachers to understand this. It's totally fine to model this vulnerability.
And parents?
Well, interesting one. We, for a long time, especially before I had kids, I was saying to parents, we need to back off and just back our teachers in and understand that they will make mistakes, and that's okay because the human beings are imperfect. They're going to make mistakes. Mm. And to let your kids fight their own battles. Don't go in and sort of jump into the teacher and say, this is what's going on, let it all happen. Now I'm a parent, I'm understanding. I understand why it's a very hard thing to do. But I think as a generalisation, I think as parents, we're just doing way too much for our kids right now.
Yeah.
And I say that that's for, kids who, on the spectrum, or parents of kids on the spectrum, their life is about fighting battles for their kids. That's not a blanket statement, obviously. But I do think kids need to fail a little bit more. I mean, this community I lived with up in the Himalayas.
Be allowed to fail.
Oh, some of the stuff that was a bit ridiculous, the stuff they were allowed to do on the playground, but hurt themselves all the time, and it was just, it's fine. There was no first aid for them to go to. They just kept going, and I felt like those kids, it's very different, the approaches we have here. I think it used to be called helicopter parenting. I think it's like drone parenting right now. It's just right over the top of them. But I think we've got to back off and back our teachers in, and they will do things occasionally that are unfair for your kids, but life's unfair. Well, what better place to learn in a school setting that life is unfair? It's a safe setting to learn that life's unfair.
Up to a point.
Yeah, of course. I mean, if your kid is not going to... I think if... A couple of things. If your child can do something themselves, just let them do it themselves. But I think if you feel like it's a problem they will not be able to sort out by themselves, absolutely, you can jump in. But if you think they'll sort it out by themselves, just let them work it out for themselves.
Yeah. Patrick, one other layer in all of the whole debate about mental health care, of course, are the GPs. The GPs themselves are struggling, just as GPs. We are reading now regularly about the breakdown in the system of GPs.
Yeah.
But GPs are for so many people with mental illness, the GPs are the first line, aren't they?
Yeah.
And it's my clear impression that in many instances they just are not able to cope. They're, in a lot of cases, I hear, their first line is try and find an available psychologist if they feel that somebody needs the psychologist. Yeah. But of course, the 6-12 month waiting list. So they prescribe antidepressants.
Yeah, that's definitely the case. Just before I get on to the GPs, could I just say something about teachers, Kerry?
Yes.
I've got a colleague who's a researcher and a clinician, and she's done great research looking at teachers and what they understand and what they... And this is secondary schools, not primary schools, but teachers are very knowledgeable. That they can recognise when a kid is at risk or needs help, but they can't get the next step, you know. I mean, there are mental health professionals going into schools in Victoria now, so that's going to be a little bit easier. But then getting that kid into appropriate help is a real problem for those teachers. They're unsupported. 48% of people who develop a serious mental illness will have dropped out of high school. So there's a huge opportunity there. The kids that are struggling and dropping out of high school, if they were screened and assessed and helped, you would probably... That would be a very powerful preventive strategy for early intervention strategy. With GPs, absolutely. We had a meeting in Canberra yesterday. I think Mark Butler described the GP situation as the scariest number he's actually seen. That something like 14% of doctors want to be GPs now. 30, 40 years ago, it was like 70%.
Yeah.
And even 20 years ago, it was maybe 50%. So the floor has fallen out of it because it's so poorly supported, so poorly remunerated now, and they're persecuted as well. So they've got a pretty hard time. We try really hard to embed GPs in headspaces, but financial model of headspace doesn't support that properly, so we can't recruit and retain them very easily as well. But they're very, very important, and many of them are very understanding about mental health. A number are not really tuned into it, and they maybe for the reasons you suggested, they overprescribe because there's nothing else you can do, you know, for that patient. I think the tiers of care, the vertical integration of care is what we need in mental health, whether it's with teachers or with GPs. It's the same issue. They're both primary care people, if you want to look at it that way. Yeah.
So coming here tonight, I wasn't really expecting that we were going to be reaching up to a peak of optimism by the end of the discussion, but because I know that there are such fundamental flaws and that there are such big challenges. Yeah. I'll ask each of you to finish. Do you see a bright light in there somewhere? You?
When I talk with kids... Oh, my hamstring's cramping. Sorry. Oh, I'm not joking. It's actually cramping. Sorry. You stretched me out, Patrick. Sorry. Oh, hamstring cramps.
You must have come economy, did you?
Oh. I ran when I got... I shouldn't have done that. I can't believe this just happened.
Running's bad for you.
Oh, I was nearly on the floor for a second there.
We'll go to Patrick first.
No, I've got this. I can do this. This is resilience. Everyone can. This is a real life test of my resilience. I'll do this. Okay.
Focus on your hamstring, and I'll come to Patrick, and then I'll come back to you.
Sorry. When we were talking yesterday on the phone, I was probably highlighting the things that still need to be done, the glass half empty sort of situation. But I think we've made a lot of progress in Australia. Australia's kind of the country you can do these innovations and reforms in, you know. And I think I always think we're at a tipping point. It's like if you scratch the surface of every politician or every member of the audience too, we know we're on a winner here if getting this issue addressed, because everyone connects to it, everyone can relate to it, like your family, my family, everyone's family, and we know we're getting a raw deal. We're all getting a raw deal. So the missing ingredient is not to beat the politicians around the head, because we would be pushing on an open door. What hasn't happened is the public has not risen up like they did with the NDIS. The public sort of rose up and said, we've got to look after these poor people with disability, physical disability, and look at the positivity that came out of that. That has not happened. The public have not actually mobilised in their own self-interest. It's the main public health problem that could transform the country if it was actually properly addressed. It could be properly addressed, but we need the people. The people are the key here. So I do feel optimistic. I feel that we're in the right country to make these gains, and we have made progress. but it's just not good enough so far.
And in terms of imperatives, Patrick, we now have the knowledge, and we now do understand about prevention. We do understand about early intervention. Mm. We also know that if a child is mentally ill, or a young adolescent is mentally ill, and they go untreated or poorly treated, then by the time they're a young adult and by the time they've reached 30, they're probably buggered for the rest of their lives.
Yeah, they're on the scrap heap. This is the concept of mental wealth. So when we go and talk to the treasurers, various treasurers, and they say, well, we've got to treat cancer, you know, in the over 80s, you know, and we've got to treat, we've got to do the NDIS. Here we've got a proposition which returns on investment, something like 7 to 1. If you treat even the most serious mental illnesses like schizophrenia early and effectively, you save money, it pays $7 for every dollar invested. So it's a no-brainer from that point of view. So I think, yeah, I think it's that concept of mental wealth, strengthening the society, stopping those kids being on the scrap heap. Saving lives is the biggest killer of young people, suicide. Yes. You know, I mean, that girl that died the weekend before last, I mean, a massive tragedy, you know, could have been prevented. Mm.
Now, here your hamstring seems to have settled.
Sorry, that wasn't me trying to get out of the question. It wasn't. I've come back to what I started with, my sister's story, and I think on the topic of hope, my sister is an extraordinary story of hope and resilience. And for anyone watching this right now who is going through a tough time right now, anyone who's streaming this at home watching, who is struggling right now, my sister's an incredible story of hope and resilience because she's really good now. And she was really bad for quite a long time. So for the individuals watching, there absolutely is hope. There's an enormous amount of work to be done to completely re-look at the way that we're dealing with this whole issue. I think for the young people I speak to at the moment, we speak to a lot of young people, one of the things that really seems to hit home for them of kids from primary school up to secondary school is just the reminder, and I'm saying this so you can talk to your young people, just the reminder that they are enough as they are. There are so many messages out there in society right now, whether it's through social media or advertising, that they're not enough. They need to be a bit, they need to look better, they need to have more friends, they need to be funnier, they need to be, you know, wealthier, whatever it is. We are all enough as we are. And I think we forget that a lot. I think our young people are not getting that message, that they are enough as they are. And I think that's really important. You know, when I just say those words to young people and you can see the look in their eyes of how desperate they needed to hear that. And I think that's, for me, if I'm thinking of my sister's journey, but then also just a message of hope that you can pass on to the people you love who might be struggling. I think that's an important one.
Hugh Van Kylenburg, Patrick McGorry, thank you both very much for what you've brought to us tonight. Thank you.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. My name's Mick Auckland. I'm the Director of Programming at Hotter, and it's my great honour to thank tonight's guests and to stand in for Karina Gerke, our CEO. Hugh, hamstring, okay?
You're...
Okay, well, we'll find out afterwards. Hugh, wonderful to see you as a fanboy before Patrick arrived. But more than that, Hugh, very humbling to hear of your first experiences with mental health and your sister's illness and the impact that that had on you and your family. And Hugh, I wish that as a primary school teacher you had found that superpower to stop mental illness, but I reflect that perhaps you have, and that perhaps that's the Resilience Project, and that that project does indeed go a long way to helping a lot of people not move down a mental illness path. You noted that we're carrying way too much at the moment, and I think I should throw that back at you. Your project is addressing 500,000 children next year, and you've got 3 children under the age of 6. So you are creating a massive impact and carrying way too much for one person. I'm sure you have a massive organisation helping you, but take care of yourself.
Thank you.
Patrick, you set off a light bulb in my head when you identified the distinction between positive mental health and the treatment of mental illness and the difference between those two concepts. It was alarming to hear from you that the battle still exists to keep optimism, recovery and prevention as the main mindset and at the forefront of people's approach. And that concept of an illusion of severity versus your great phrase, an oasis of care. And wouldn't it be wonderful if we could rise up and force our governments to create more oases of care? Is that a word? Oases of care. Alarming to hear that the pecking order for psychiatry exists in the way that it does, especially in the public health system where you sit very much at the bottom, even though, as you say, the illness that you treat sits very much at the top of the prevalence in Australian society. Still a gap between awareness and actual reform, but again, heartening to hear your opinion, and you expressed it again towards the end, that Australia is leading the way, even though affirmative action is still quite lacking. I was horrified to hear that there's been a 50% rise in young people being identified with mental health issues, as I'm sure everyone here was, although I dare say the murmurs that ran through the audience on a number of occasions indicate that most people have a strong affinity to the issue tonight. And I did hear that murmur of agreement run around when you were talking about the early dismantling of the mental health care and the concurrent failure to build social capacity to support those people who were left behind when that system was dismantled, and the blockages to care at a primary level, meaning that people with needs simply can't be seen. Kerry, you touched on the anxiety of an epidemic of an anxiety of disorders. And is there a common element? And we were told that the early stages of any problem actually starts with anxiety, and that anxiety is a gateway to more serious problems. Hugh, as the father of a 10-year-old daughter, I was already terrified about social media and devices. I, like you, I'm grateful I grew up before both, and I struggle to understand how to deal with them in today's world where her peers already seem to have iPhone 14s and she wonders why we won't let her. And I would just warn you that hotel balconies during Schoolies Week, you're going to be a target, and they will be calling you a toolie, so stay off them. There was discussion about the pandemic and our increased addiction to devices and social media during the pandemic, but what a wonderful concept that we should look to some of these technology companies to help us use those devices and use that social medium to become a better version of ourselves rather than a copycat version of a social influencer or an unrealistic ideal. Heartening also to hear that there are movements to use those devices and apps for the good of mental health and to create safe spaces. And Kerry, you asked if the prevalence of measuring individuals and the success-driven model was a factor. And Patrick, you went on to explain that the challenge really exists in defining what you described as the fuzzy boundary and our ability to trust young people when they know that they need to seek help. And that often when you're at the starting line of needing to seek help, it feels normal and you can't identify that yourself. So that's a real conundrum. Why is there no sense of urgency around the required resources and building the capacity? And unfortunately, at that point, I moved side stage and the conversation was quite muffled. But I did pick up that we are hearing very clearly that the need exists for the public to rise up, to put pressure on the people who make decisions, who control budgets and control the issues. And from Hugh, the final word, there is always hope. So nothing more from me other than to thank Hugh, Patrick, Kerry, for another wonderful conversation, but also to extend my thanks to Caroline and her team at Griffith and to the Griffith live streaming and technical events team backstage, to the Hodder producing, production, front of house and technical teams. And I'd also like to, of course, acknowledge Karina Gerke, Hodder CEO, who's championed this project along with Caroline and who is very quite rightly proud of all the conversations we've hosted to date. Finally, I'd like to thank you, the audience here live in the theatre and those watching online. Without an audience listening, there is no conversation. And we thank you for taking the time out of your day to join us tonight. We look forward to welcoming you back in 2023. Thank you.